For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning. Taigen and I have talked about me coming out and visiting for some time now, and we set the date almost 6 months ago, and it crept up, and here it is. So I was right in the middle of opening a new restaurant, which opened last Friday while I was here. So anyway, I hope they're doing fine without me. I'm sure they are. Anyway, I'm very pleased to be here. I've never been to Chicago before for any length of time, just passed through. And I find it quite pleasant and quite wonderful. And I've met maybe six of the Sangha members here, and they're wonderful people. I'm very glad, very sincere seekers. I'm very encouraged and very happy to have met them. I bombed into Tassajara on a Norton Atlas motorcycle in 67 with all my worldly possessions, which was some camping gear and a girlfriend, and planned to spend 4 days and ended up spending 4 years, because I met the teacher who I'd never met before. I'd heard about him, and I had friends that was involved in San Francisco Zen Center, but I'd never been there, and I never met the teacher before. But when I did meet him, I realized immediately that I could learn something from him, and that I needed to learn something from him. And so I ended up staying I was staying indefinitely, but shortly after he ordained me, he sent me to Japan to come back and build temples in America. Anyway, building temples in America turned out to be not so easy to do, because Americans don't like traditional things. They like American things. They like the immediate things. And so I ended up building some temples in Europe, but not so much in America. But I ended up instead building palaces for rich people. So that's anyway, just by karmic coincidence, that's the way it ended up. Anyway, when I first arrived at Tassajara, one of the I'm going to talk about Suzuki Roshi this morning, just because people here seem quite interested in him. I was here for the Thursday talk, and you were actually reading his book, which is not done in California anymore. Anyway, it was quite gratifying to see that. And I think there's some interest in him as a person and how he taught. That is always the big question of how to teach. So I'm going to talk about Suzuki Roshi this morning. I'll talk about my building practice and my design practice this afternoon, which is what I normally talk about. I very seldom ever talk about Buddhism directly. And then Monday, I want to talk about East-West, how to teach Buddhism in the West, how it's taught in the East, and how the intersection between the two. But I'll leave most of that for Monday. Anyway, I'd had a little bit of initiation into Eastern philosophy, mostly through reading Taoist and being interested in Taoism, which is a very safe thing to be interested in, because there's no real record of what you have to do. There's not a clear practice. You can sort of make it up on your own. So that's very safe, but not very rewarding. And and I'd heard about the Zen practice, but it was this thing where they rang bells and everybody did the same thing and they wore all the same clothes, and it was a sort of like zombies in a row. And I thought for sure that couldn't be the real thing, because the real thing was the hermit in the mountains communing with nature. I had one great drawback with that idea, though, that there were no girls in nature communing with out there in nature. So, and I was a rather skivvy is the Japanese word. Anyway, I was enthusiastic about the opposite sex as a young man. Anyway, we arrived at Tassajara unannounced. And I had heard that the Zen Center bought Tassajara, had been there the year before for more recreational reasons, and that they were planning to fix the place up. And I'd gone through the union apprenticeship and had bought and remodeled and sold a house. So I had money that I was going to go to Japan on, but I didn't know any Japanese people. I didn't know any Japanese language. I'd never been out of the country before, so I was a little nervous about doing it. And when I met Shunryu Suzuki, I realized that this would be a good place to learn something about what I was going to do. After three years, he asked me if I would how I could serve humanity better by being a priest or by being a carpenter, and I was really addicted to both of that by that time, both the meditation practice and building and design. And after some struggle, I chose the priest. I told the priest route, and which his response was, which was sort of a non-committal statement that he heard me. And sometime later, he announced that the Reb and I were going to be ordained. And then shortly after that, about 6 months after that, he announced to the general population that he was sending me to Japan to study temple building. He's only going to send me for 1 year. He said to the, he hadn't asked me anything about it, but he told this, announced this to the general sangha that he was sending me. And anyway, and then afterwards he whispered in my ear. He said, "You should stay 5 years." So he had sent a number of people to Japan to practice, mostly at Eiheiji and at his original temple that his son was running, Rinzōin, that's correct, I got them mixed up. Anyway, and they had either crashed over there or come back and crashed and burned. I mean, it was the cultural divide was extremely difficult, and nobody had really successfully done it at that time. Anyway, Japan in its traditional sense is very, very different from the Western, from the West. But anyway, I'll talk more about that Monday. Anyway, Suzuki Roshi's teaching was, his style of teaching was very, very open, very broad. Any of you have read his book, The Beginner's Mind book, you know about the idea of giving your sheep a big pasture or putting a snake in a bamboo tube. So he did not do any tube stuffing. He was all about big pasture. And he was very, very generous with us and very grateful, actually, for us. And he was also had been sick as a young man. He was not really robust, healthy, in a healthy sense. And he was predicted to die in his 30s, but he had, by this time he was in his early 60s. So he felt a certain sense of borrowed time that way, I think. But he also had not a strong sexual imprint. He was neither strongly male nor strongly female. He was sort of asexual in the energy that he projected. So, and he was also very, very gentle, very, very nurturing, to the point where he thought that it was a detriment. He thought his teaching was lacking. He would often say that he was not strict enough with us, which I'll get to at a time. But so he was very, and he let us. He was sort of. We were quite a band of wild ones. It attracted. When Tassajara opened, it attracted excessive people from all over the country and from Europe as well. It was like the first real place that you could have contact with Asia in the Western world. Tartang Tuku, the Tibetan teacher, came along shortly afterwards. But anyway. So it attracted us a number of quite over the top people, and he enjoyed it, and he was quite grateful for it, and he was quite accepting of it. And for example, we told him when we first got there, Tassajara was an old hot springs resort. It had been in the 1880s. It had been established as a hot springs resort, and people used to come from far away to come and take the baths there, which was a fashionable thing to do in Europe and America in the turn of the last century. And so that had these natural hot springs plunges, which was part of our daily routine. And we told them, oh, in America, boys and girls, men and women bathe together. Which he said, okay, because in Japan, that's the way they used to do it a long time ago. And this was, you know, this is the 60s, so this was not... This was definitely where our minds were at. And it wasn't until Katagiri Roshi came along the next year and said, no, they do not bathe together. And they had separated us. They had boys, male and female hours from then on. Anyway, and also at that time, macrobiotics was the craze. That was even called Zen macrobiotics, but why, I don't know. They like to tag Zen onto all kinds of strange things, but... But macrobiotics was the craze, was the food craze of the moment, and we had the Loring Palmer, the chef, the original chef, was a very skillful and very knowledgeable macrobiotic cook, and so all of our meals were macrobiotic in the early days. And Tsukiroshi just went along with it. He did not. His idea about food and diet was that you should eat 80% of what you could eat. So moderation was his idea of what diet would be, but he allowed us to go on this crazy macrobiotic binge where we ate a lot of brown rice, a lot of lentils, one egg every other day, so very low protein, cheese maybe twice a month or something. And we were following the old schedule of the lunar calendar, which is a 30-day month, and so you divide the so-called week up into 5 and 10 days in a decimal system, so every tenth day was the five and the ten days were the altered schedule days. When I was working in Japan with the craftsmen in Japan, we worked that way also. Although Japan has a 7-day week like the rest of the Western world, it's still the old school is the first, the Suitachi Jugo Nichi is the first and the 15th are the days off. Anyways, we followed that schedule at Tassajara in those days, but The food was definitely this macrobiotic, which was something that was developed during the war in Japan. And I had been a construction worker in Berkeley, California before I went there, and I weighed 180 pounds, very little, almost no body fat, and I would eat. That typical dinner would be a chicken, a quart of milk, and a loaf of bread. So I was working hard and eating hard. And I went down there, and it was like brown rice and lentils, no protein, little miso soup. And we all shaved our heads because that was sort of the thing to do. And after the first practice period, which was a summer practice period, that very first year with a lot of people, I got down to 145 pounds. So in the fall, when I came back to see my family, they all thought I'd been in a concentration camp because shaved heads and an emaciated body. Anyway, after a while, I learned to metabolize the diet and came back up to about 165 pounds and stayed there until I left. So he tried to teach us by asking us to do many things, mostly things that we would maybe call mindfulness now, although that term is not used much. One of the things we did was, or in the beginning, was we tore down this old rickety part of the baths over the top of the rooms above the baths that were torn down, and there was all these wooden shingles from it. We saved the wood, but there was wooden shingles, and he had us tie them all up into very neat bundles and take them out to where the stockpile where trash was kept and stack them up neatly, and they sat there for many years and slowly slipped back into the ground and decomposed. Well, we wrapped them up very neatly anyway. So there's this attention to the details and attention to whatever it is you have and that you come in contact with. It made a deep impression on me, and it's kind of what I'm doing now with this Japanese concept of motainai, not to waste. So this is sort of my practice is generated into a motainai practice currently. Anyway, he launched into form and emptiness as a teaching early on. That was early. He would lecture every day. There'd be a lecture, except for the four and nine days, and there'd be a study period where we would study, and then we would. So basically, we would meditate 6 hours. Work 6 hours, sleep 6 hours, and then the rest of the 6 hours was split between bathing and studying and doing laundry or whatever. But we did the laundry on the days off. Didn't do laundry during the weekdays. And there was no Tassajara is very hot and dry, and there was no heating in the Zendo. And there certainly wasn't even electricity, so we didn't have electricity. All the lighting was with kerosene. And his response was, when it's hot, be a hot Buddha. When it's cold, be a cold Buddha. So sometimes we get down to 20 degrees in the Zendo, but it gave you the opportunity of learning how to control your body heat so that you could actually warm yourself just by with your mind, basically, which is something that is common in Japan, but not very common in this country, and I thought was a great opportunity. And one of the very first teachings that I remember was in the beginning we sat. We sat in a smaller room, a room about this size, in the very beginning before the practice period started, in the first month or two of Tassara's existence. And we were fixing up the old bar restaurant of the resort to be the meditation hall. But this building and room was it's now the guest dining room, but at that time it was the owner's living quarters. So we took out all the interior walls and made it into one big room, and we had our zendo in there, and then we would eat in there. Not Orioki style, that came later, but we would eat in there with bowls that we brought in. And in, for example, we'd have like oatmeal in the morning, and we would also have milk and honey with it, and we would pass along Angamacio, the salt. And so that was just what people were used to, that eating milk and honey. And he never said anything about it. Except for one day, somebody forgot to put the milk and honey out. And so in the middle of the meal, he's eating there with it. He said, "Oh, I'm so glad that you found out that the taste of cereal is so much better just by itself and not needing to cover it up with milk and honey. So I'm so glad that you discovered that." So that was the end of the milk and honey. We never had milk and honey after that. But anyway, rather than being sort of preachy and didactic, he found chances to let us discover the practice on our own. His only real rules in the beginning were: don't smoke marijuana and don't catch the fish. There was fish in that Kasara Creek. There's trout. So those are the only two sort of spoken rules. But then also not to run, never to run. That was also an early rule. That even if you were late or you needed to go somewhere, you should walk calmly from place to place. Who happened to show up in your cabin at night was never discussed. What you ordered on the town trip once a week, they would send a truck into town over this torturous mountain road to get the mail and to bring in provisions. And you could order stuff on that from the town trip if you wanted to. If you wanted to order a canned ham on the town trip, you were allowed to do that. You had to keep it in your room you wouldn't eat it in public, but you were not. There was not a moralistic thing about what you ate or not ate. So it was very, very, very forgiving in many ways. But the schedule was very strict. Schedule was arduous. It started early in the morning and went late at night. We had somebody would run through the camp with a bell waking everybody up, and at night they would go around with the kaishaku, with the sounding sticks, and making sure all the lights were out. And if you didn't get up and come to Zazen, they sent somebody to your room to see if you were dying or not. So it was sort of, you kind of had to be dying before you were excused from Zazen. But he never got involved with that. That was pretty much, in any group you can find a few diehards that are willing to that are just itching to impose the rules on the rest of the sangha. So there was never a problem finding somebody to do that. But he never got involved in that. And he also sent for a young priest from Japan, a man named Kobuchino. He came right straight from Aheiji to Tassajara without hardly any introduction to Western life. But it was very educational for us to see what another another Japanese teacher how they taught. And then Katagiri came along. He was mostly came to San Francisco for the San Francisco congregation, but he would come down and teach at Tassajara periodically as well. And because Tassajara was an unusual location, and it was the 60s, we would get a lot of people coming down the road in various different costumes and guises, wanting to share their understanding of Martian speak with us, or their insight into the true Hindu meaning of the world, or and any number of cultish and psychotic ideas that were current at the time. And I remember this one person that was really deranged was there, and it was my job at that time to get them to not come in, to get them to go away. And I was talking to Suzuki Roshi about it. I say, well, what? This person is really deluded, you know. How should I deal with this, you know? And he said, you have to remember that we are all deluded. And that made a big impression on me, because it's so true. We just are very comfortable with our own delusions and those of our friends, but they're no crazier than people that we label crazy. Anyway, at a certain point, there was a large congregation in the city as well, and he spent part of his time in the city. Suzuki did part of his time in the city, part of Tassajara, and especially in the winter, he was down at Tassajara as much as he could be. But he felt, like I said, he felt that he was not strict enough with us, and so he sent to Japan for this. The roughest, toughest priest from Aheiji, who was the Tanto, which is sort of like the dean, just sort of like the enforcer. And he was also the sumo wrestling champ of Aheiji. Anyway, so he came and he had also never been out of the country before in his life either, never been out of Japan, so he had no real understanding of Westerners. Suzuki had been in America for maybe 5 years, or more than that. He came in 58, so it was almost 10 years before we had Tassajara, 9 years before Tassajara. So he had a lot of experience with Westerners. And he had a meditation in an old Jewish synagogue on Bush Street in San Francisco. And during the summer, at times we would go up to San Francisco, and there were people had houses across the street. It wasn't residential, but there were houses close by. And his teaching up there was like, if you're walking on the street and you see a piece of paper or waste or something thrown away on the ground, pick it up because you dropped it. I mean, take responsibility for your environment. Don't think that it's somebody else's responsibility. That made an impression. He also wanted us, even though the houses were directly across the street, he wanted us to walk to the corner, wait for the light, cross to the light, and walk back to our houses, not jaywalk across the street, which, when you're high energy in your 20s, is a hard thing to do. Even when you get older, it's a hard thing to do. What else did he have us do at that time? He would have. It was one of the rooms that we sat in. One of the rooms of the, not in the main hall of the synagogue, but one of the. It was like a meeting room upstairs, in the front in the synagogue. We had cushions in there on the floor, without any tons, like here, and he would. He would run. He would have zazen there. He usually did all the bells himself. He hadn't delegated that, but he would also not necessarily follow the clock. So you would never know if zazen was going to be 40 minutes long or an hour and a half long. And so it was a little unnerving that way. And I never quite understood whether that was just to keep us off balance or because he'd fallen asleep. Else, and then he would go to his office, which was kind of like where this back door here is, and then we would go, and it was the second floor, and we'd go through his office into the hallway and then down the stairs to the outside, and we would all line up and go through one at a time in a line, and he would gassho to us each one individually. And one time, I'd been out of Tassajara for maybe a year at this time, going through, and he gassho'd to me, and then he reached down in the waste paper basket and pulled out a flyer for Japanese, some sort of Japantown flyer for Japanese stuff. I don't know what it was. It was all in Japanese, no English. And gave it to me like it was a precious present, and I kept it for many years. I hung on to it as if it was a precious present. But the act of giving was just so. I mean, I was very touched by it, even though it was a piece of throwaway out of the garbage can.
Did you ever find out what it said?
No. And at the same time. He was not very animated when he did. He was very, very quiet when he bowed to us, almost like he was asleep, or his energy was pulled way inside. And it took a long time for everybody to go through and leave. And we had one of his star students, who later became his successor. Was a very important, self-important anyway, person, and he didn't really have time to stand there in line and go through all this. So he would sometimes cut out the side door and go down the hall and go down the stairs. And one day, Suzuki Roshi caught him doing that, and he immediately jumped, and ran to the balcony. And as he was going down the stairs, he reached over, bam, 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 bam. Hit him with a stick. That's also in those days we had the kiyosaku. We had the stick. People would take turns carrying the stick and hitting you on the shoulders if you were asleep or if you asked for it.
We don't do that here.
What?
We don't do that here.
They don't do that anywhere anymore. I don't think. Not that I know of, anyway.
Sometimes go around and rub people's shoulders during session.
Anyway, I don't generally talk about this kind of thing. So, just being here now and talking to people here, stuff. A lot of this stuff is sort of flooding back. I don't have it organized in a systematic way, but. I thought that some of you, since you are reading his book and since this is his tradition, would be interested in his teaching style. Anyway, at a certain point, he brought this teacher, Tatsugami, to do a winter practice period in Tassajara. And he spoke no English. And... He spoke no English, and Katagiri, they called him Sensei at that time, but now called Katagiri Roshi, translated for him. So we would have this lecture, mid-morning lecture, in Japanese that would go on for close to an hour, and then we would have this translation in English that would go on for about as long. But Katagiri did not agree with Tatsugami in the Zen philosophy, so, and his English was a little garbled anyway, and so it was unintelligible. They were both unintelligible. But you had to sit there through both of them. It was a lot easier to sit Zazen than it is to sit there with a lecture going on. But that was one of the things that Suzuki Roshi used to always say. He says, I am lecturing to you now and I am telling you things, but you are better off hearing him asleep. Do not think that you are gaining some information from this lecture, which was also a novel concept. Anyway, Tatsugami could be so strict with us because he didn't understand us or didn't know where our buttons were to be pushed, and his hallmarks. Almost all teachers have a hallmark saying, and his was "Get on the railroad tracks of Dogen Zenji's way." That was his phrase that he liked, the railroad tracks of Dogen Zenji's way, which is a very, very Japanese concept. That's just very, very Japanese. That's the way the whole country runs. It runs on railroad tracks. Everything runs very smoothly and orderly and on a timely schedule. Anyway, it's because we did not have direct contact with his verbal teaching, and he did not introduce too many new teachings, new practices, I should say. At least I can't remember any right now. That he introduced to the community. He was there. I think it was the second or third year. Maybe this, I don't know. I have a very poor sense of chronological time. But we had this small kitchen. Like I say, it was the size of this room where they cooked for everybody. And at that time, Ed Brown, as some of you know from the Tassar Bread Cookbook. A lot of people have that book throughout the country. Was the main chef there, and we were moving slightly away from macrobiotics, but it was still very sparse food, and people would in the middle of the night sneak into the kitchen and steal food, and Ed would even sometimes sit Zazen on the kitchen counter with knives in his hands there, you know, so protecting the food. You know. Anyway. So we went to Tatsugami and said, "What are we going to do about this?" And he said, "Take the locks off your mind and put them on the door." Which I thought, in retrospect and thinking about it, I thought was actually brilliant, but it is also totally Japanese. And this, maybe I should discuss this more on Monday, but it's just so we in the West here are so involved in being disciplining ourselves, having a moral compass, taking on the burden of right and wrong on our own shoulders. Where in Japan they just say this is right and that's wrong and this is the way we do it. It's not a question. So that was another real major insightful, the idea of locking the door and taking that. I mean, it applies so much to so many things. in everyday life. And at some point, this Danish fellow, Niels Holmes, came down the road, and he came in a car full of young wanderers who had a jug of wine in the car, and he's a very gregarious person, and so he was drinking in the car with him, and he shows up pretty drunk at the monastery gate and wants to come in. And he said, "I'm sorry to come to the monastery so drunk, but I'm going to practice." You know, anyway, he stayed and he became a close friend. And he had had woodworking experience in Denmark, and so we worked together building the kitchen at Ta Sahara. That was a project that we did together. And he and I people would take turns baking the bread at night for the next day. And he and I baked bread one evening, and after the loaves came out, we thought of a sample just to see how it came out. And it tasted so good, and a little butter on it tasted even better. We ended up eating a loaf apiece and a pound of butter, and we were banned from the kitchen from there on. I never got to go to the kitchen until I came back from Japan. Anyway, that's sort of the sense of the practice at Ta Sahara in those early days. It was very sincere and very intense, but also a little wild. Anyway, if anybody has any questions or something they would like to discuss, I'd be happy to talk about it.
So you've been there at Ta Sahara for some time, then you went to Japan for a number of years, and then you came back. What did you see when you got back? I mean, did it seem like the same thing, or
No, it was very different. The analogy, or the signpost that I like to use is that before I went to Japan, the people that were there went outside to pee, and after I got back, they came inside to pee. Boys and girls. Anyway, it was a different crowd. They were mostly college educated and a lot less crazy, and they were students of Richard Baker's. And almost all of the people that I knew at Ta Sahara, except for a very few, had gone to study with Trungpa in Colorado. And Trungpa considered Suzuki Roshi his teacher. They always had a Suzuki Roshi plaque on their altar at Trungpa's temples. And he would lecture. A number of quite extraordinary teachers came through Ta Sahara at various times. But he would come, and he came several times and lectured there. One time he came and lectured. He was amazingly clear. I don't know if any of you ever met him, but he could expound the Dharma in a way that you had to hear it. You couldn't sort of not hear it. It sunk in somehow. It didn't just bounce off you like a lot of lectures do. He was able to say it in a way that penetrated right to your inner being. But he also drank a whole quart of Jim Beam at the same time. So that was, he was definitely, you know, Tibetans like to play with magic, and he was definitely had a lot of magic tricks. And being able to be totally lucid, totally clear, and drink a whole fifth of whiskey at the same time was one of his little things. But the people that came back, they were orderly, sincere, and they were like my friend here.
Do you remember
or what do you remember of Suzuki Roshi's talks from when you lived at Furutasahara with him?
Well, I don't remember any of the particulars. He talked about form and emptiness. That was a little lecture series of that. He did a lecture series on the Sandokai. He
in terms of the spirit of how it was when he talked.
He did not put a lot of emphasis on it. He was doing it more like he felt he needed to do it than he thought that that you did not get the sense that he was really, really eager for you to understand. His teaching was much more physical, much more based on meditation and chanting than it was on intellectual content. And poor Koban, this fresh young priest from Aheiji, he was so unnerved and he had learned English. He had pretty good English. He learned English in college, and Suzuki Roshi told him he had a lecture, and he would lecture, and certain times he would lecture daily, and he was so unnerved by it that he would fall asleep while he was lecturing, which is a little unusual to see. That he would actually fall asleep while he was lecturing. But then that's the East-West difference again. if the Japanese respond to terror by going to sleep, or we respond by getting agitated and moving around a lot.
Are there questions, please, about any aspect of false experience?
Well, that's kind of like, just because you mentioned Trungpa Rinpoche way back when is how I got started on this.
Okay.
I never met Suzuki Roshi. I've always known about their friendship, or their relationship, it's kind of almost a father-son kind of thing. But they seem so, their demeanor is so extraordinarily different. I mean, I can't even imagine them interacting.
Well, Suzuki liked everybody. The only time I ever saw him be critical, one time we would have these end of practice period dinner and skits, and people would do skits at the end of practice period, and earlier in that practice period we'd had a visit from a German man that had studied in Tibet named Lama Govinda. You may have heard of him, so you may have heard of Lama Govinda. And he had a long beard, and he wore red cloak of some kind. I think it was the fall practice period, end of practice period dinner, and everybody was doing various things. And Suzuki took the red tablecloth off the table and wrapped it around, and we had Indian corn on the table as a decoration, sort of like you do it at Thanksgiving. And he took the Indian corn and put the husk up under his chin like this, and hung down like he had the red cloak, and he danced around sort of making fun of Lama Govinda. That was the only time I ever saw him be critical of anybody. I never saw him be critical. That was the closest he ever got. And at one point after the first practice period, I went back to the city, and I had stored some of my tools in my parents' house, and I was going to bring them down because by that time I was already hooked and going to stay there and start helping build the place up again. And we had a Toyota Land Cruiser station wagon that we used to go back and forth in those days. And there was maybe the driver and Suzuki and maybe three or four of us in the inn, and then we were taking a bunch of stuff down. And we went by my parents' house in Berkeley, and my stepfather was out in the front mowing the lawn in a pair of overalls, and my stepfather was African American, and when I said that's I told Suzuki that's my father, and he said, and he perked up, and my stepfather's a very gregarious person, but he was mowing the lawn and drinking a beer, and he stopped mowing, he took the beer can, he stuck it in the bib pocket of his overalls, and shook hands with Suzuki, and they both have just beamed. I mean, there was just this amazing sort of meeting of, it was a very, very powerful meeting. I was quite amazed by that. It was my early association with him, but he was unconditionally glad to meet people, and he was that way with Trumpa too. And Trumpa realized that Suzuki had a large sangha and knew how to teach Westerners, and he was sort of wanted to piggyback on it, as far as I can see. But anyway, I think that's where that came from. But he was an appropriate teacher for a lot of those wild people that were part of that first group.
Other questions, comments, responses, please.
Anyway, this afternoon I'll talk about building, about design, and then Monday I want to hear from you folks, and I want to discuss this issue of how the East-West, how to bring something that is so culturally so embedded and so different into the United States or into the Western world in general, and how to do it without losing the essence of the teaching. Anyway, this is a big question for me. When I left Zen Center, what I wanted to do was go to Tassajara and build a traditional training temple at Tassajara. And I had told this plan to Suzuki before I left, and he said, "Yes, you should do that." So I had that as my teacher's mandate. But by the time that I was available to do that, Zen Center had changed considerably, and politically it was not happening. It was not. There was a very different vibe. It was much more emphasis on lay practice and much more emphasis on being part of the world, the big world, and not being special. So I was not allowed to go to Tassajara after transmission. And I had this idea. I've been doing retreat practice in Japan, taking people to Japan and doing retreats, mostly at Rinso Inn, at Suzuki Roshi's old temple, where his son was. And I'd also been doing some building in the off time, and I'd built a lot of stuff at Zen Center. I had a crew of 12 people that I trained. And we built a lot of stuff at Green Gulch and other places until Baker left. And then the building all stopped, and then I went into training the new students in the Zendo training. So I had this sort of idea, this sort of very naive idea that I could do woodworking half the time or part of the time and retreat practice part of the time. Well, once I started the building, I had clients, I had workers, I had a lease on a shop, I had insurance policies that just ran away with me, and there was no retreat. but now I'm retired. I'm doing design, but I'm not doing construction anymore, and I think I'm going to try now doing doing more talking, like, you know, talking meditation practice, talking practice, rather than my building practice has been informed by everything I learned from Suzuki. I mean, the Buddhist and even the Taoism before that. It informs that it is accompanies everything that I do in my work, but it's not didactic and it's not obvious and it's not stated openly. I try to do it through form rather than through speech.
You mentioned right at the beginning that you used to think about this kind of, or your perspective on this, a tradition like this, was that as a lot of people dress the same, doing the same thing, and how did your perspective change, assuming it did change, and what, when did your perspective change on that? I mean, pretty quickly,
but when experiencing the actual thing, it became very clear that that wasn't what it was about at all, and that understanding of form and emptiness, that you can't have freedom without having restraint. Restraint and freedom go together. This is a different discussion. This is maybe a discussion for Monday, but. That the two are integral parts of the whole, and that that's a much longer discussion. But anyway, I soon saw the value in the schedule and in the forms. That became quite clear that was in many ways liberating.
Well, that's a long discussion. Could you say a little bit more about it?
Huh?
I understand it's a long discussion.
Well, it's the whole idea that you can't see yourself until you have a framework to experience yourself against. So if you don't have a target, you don't know whether you're just shooting into the air. You don't know whether you're accurate or not. You don't know whether you're hitting, whether you are in control or not without a target. So you need some sort of form. It doesn't need whether you don't have to hit the target. You can fail. That was one of the things Suzuki used to always say. Failure. Life is one failure after the other, and failure is very important. He was very big on failure. You know, that Dylan line: "There's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all." I mean, that was very, very. I don't know where Dylan got it, but that would fit in very nicely to Suzuki Roshi's teaching. It's what practice is. Your practice is putting yourself in a situation where you are practicing, whether it's the cello or a math problem or zazen or what it is, you're putting yourself in relationship to a target, to a grid, to a framework, and then you can see, and when you bounce off of that framework, you get to see who you are. Otherwise, you have no idea. You just have your own illusionary concept of what you're doing because you don't have any feedback. People are, you know, I mean, children are a great teacher, are a great feedback loop. I mean, when you have children, you very soon learn, oh, I do that, and that's why they're acting like that, you know. And marriage, you know, marriage, living with somebody else, is also a great teaching. Very important part of it doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter whether you succeed or not. Maybe even better to fail. but you have to have a target.
Other questions, comments, responses, please.
Well, thank you very much.